if you'd said that this was going to be where we were in the terms of the geopolitics of the United Kingdom 12 months ago, you wouldn't have believed it. It's just incredible how much has changed in such a short time frame, you know. And I think this offers a really interesting case to try and capture some of that geopolitical change.
Hello, and welcome to this, the 13th episode in the Eastern Arc podcast series. My name is Phil Ward, and I'm director of the consortium. The person you just heard from was Ewan Speed, Professor of Medical Sociology at the University of Essex. He's part of a team that has just got £420,000 from the Economic and Social Research Council to look at volunteering during the pandemic in the four individual home nations of the UK, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. The voluntary sector in the UK is huge. According to the National Council for Voluntary Organisations, the NCVO, there are approximately 163,000 charities in the UK, and their work involves 21 million volunteers. The estimated value of the work is £23.9 billion. The project developed from an Eastern Arc workshop that took place in 2019. It included three of the project investigators who came together to explore areas of common and complementary interests. The project will examine how prepared each of the UK's four nations was before the pandemic hit, and what role voluntary action, organisations and volunteers played in the plans, and will assess how the work changed over the course of the year. I brought together four of the investigators to talk about the project, but we also touched on the difficulty of consensus building in Zoom meetings, and how Nicola Sturgeon handles media. There's also many, many mentions of oven ready chickens. Joining Ewan to discuss all this are Jürgen Grütz, the Director of the Institute for Volunteering Research, the IVR, at the University of East Anglia, Eddie Hogg, a Senior Lecturer in Social Policy at the University of Kent, and on the line from Newcastle, the Principal Investigator for the project, Irene Hardell, Professor of Public Policy at Northumbria University. I started by asking Eddie how the partnership came about.
Yes, so Jürgen will remind me of whether this all started in a Lebanese restaurant in Tooting or in the German gymnasium at King's Cross, but it was definitely one of the two. And Jürgen and I, we've known each other for probably a decade, but had been increasingly talking about the idea of doing some work on volunteering in health services. Essentially, I've been doing work for a while now on volunteering in education, particularly primary education, and with the Institute for Volunteering Research moving to the University of East Anglia, and particularly being sitting in a sort of school of health studies, it seemed like the right time for Jürgen and I to start thinking about that sort of work. We ummed and ahed, and in the end applied for a fairly small Eastern Arc grant to run two, in the end, workshops, one in Norwich, hosted by UEA, and one in Kent, in Canterbury, hosted by the University of Kent. And that's where we first, or where I first met Ewan. But we put together a team of probably a core team of half a dozen to 10 people, including the three of us, but also representatives from the National Council for Voluntary Organisations, from Royal Voluntary Service, and others. And was sort of toying with the idea of putting in a large scale bid. Then COVID happened and we thought, here's an opportunity. We had a research team pretty much sort of sitting, I'm not sure we say oven ready anymore after that was rather abused by the current government, but we did have a sort of oven ready research team sitting waiting. And Jürgen and I sort of started getting the band together and seeing what we could do. And I'll let Jürgen take it over from there.
Well, I can confirm that it was the German gymnasium near King's Cross. And I think when COVID happened, it was good to know each other and to have these relationships, because the ground was shifting incredibly fast under our feet. And it was two or three things that became very apparent very quickly. And the first one, it appeared that the response by the UK government wasn't really ready for what was coming. And we observed that particularly in the voluntary sector, and we observed that particularly with the then emerging mutual aid association. Very quickly, and because of the existing research collaborations, we realized that there are different developments in England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, making it incredibly complex. But it was at that point where we realized we really need others to be involved, and incredibly grateful to Irene for really then bringing together a team that could address this complicated issue.
Right since 1999, policy for the voluntary sector has been non-reserved. So we've had several decades of policy divergence for volunteering and the voluntary sector. And it hasn't really been that obvious. And there's not been that much academic debate on it. Sadly, when you're based in England, it isn't always that obvious that we have other jurisdictions taking different journeys.
What was maybe prior to COVID, something that was sort of alluded to in terms of the politics of the four jurisdictions within the UK has very much been put into stark relief by the very sort of immediate pressing public health response to the pandemic. And that for me has really been a fascinating development and something that we really hope to capture within this project. And it's become a much more explicit feature of UK politics than it was prior to 23rd of March 2020. So really that's where I come in, is trying to, I have a background in health and social policy, so trying to map and detail some of those differences and how that's sort of changed over this very short, intense period of time. It was fascinating when we put the bid in, because we're sort of watching our research unfold live. Folks are waiting to hear whether we've been funded or not. So we've got a very intense period of 6 months of activity to try and unpack how this diffusion of different ways of thinking about the response to the pandemic sort of played out across the four jurisdictions, which for me is really, we're very lucky. It's going to be a fascinating piece of work.
We wrote the bid during lockdown, which was an interesting experience in itself. And the pressure was to submit the bid at the right time when the bid was right, not to rush and submit it too soon before it really was oven ready, to use Eddie's term. We've been able to reach out and get teams representing the four jurisdictions, made up of academics and the key infrastructure organisations.
And not all bids are being funded. In fact, not all bids get eventually written and submitted or are successful. And it is the trust that people build up, and by rehearsing different exercises of working out where we are, how we think, how we approach things, that take us to a place where we can then start to develop successful bids. And then it's the leadership, for example, from Irene, who knows to say, listen, this isn't ready. Oven, microwave, or otherwise, this isn't ready. This needs to be done just right. We'll never be perfect, but so it's the combination of building up the trust over years and having the leadership to know when something is ready to submit. And I think that worked for us in this occasion.
No one had any experience of living during a pandemic. And we all naively thought that once we came out of lockdown, it would be a smooth road to recovery. We were hoping that halfway through the project, our first briefings across the four nations would be informing recovery. So lessons of hope to alleviate unmet need in social welfare, examples of a good practice, examples of partnerships and policies across our four nations that could help others. And the road to recovery is far more tricky.
I'd be interested to, both to hear the background of how since 1999 there has been that divergence, and to what degree that divergence has manifest itself. What are the differences between the four parts of the UK? And also thinking about your project itself, 6 months to do the research, and it has to have practical outcomes and to inform recovery. Eddie, could you give some background to that development of the voluntary sector in the four countries since 1999? I know that's quite a lot to ask, but just an indication of how it's changed, but also what you see as the practical outcomes that will inform recovery from this. And Jürgen and Ewan, do jump in if appropriate.
Or just carry on laughing at me because I've got the horrible question. I must admit to being one of those awful English academics that Irene characterises, who researched the voluntary sector but actually haven't paid much attentiveness to those differences, not least because, absolutely as Irene says, they've broadly not been massively noticeable because there hasn't been anything like COVID to hold in sharp relief the differences. Often things in the voluntary sector, as in the world, are often quite slow burning. So in the UK, or sorry, in England at least, we've seen the sort of decimation almost of the network of voluntary sector support organisations. So to take Kent as an example, I moved down to Kent in 2013, at which point there were still in the region of a dozen, maybe 15, different voluntary sector support infrastructure bodies covering really quite specific areas. Dover and Deal had one, the Isle of Thanet had its own, Canterbury and Whitstable had its own, and so on across Kent. Now, not that long later, there are three covering all of Kent, and they are big, multi-functioning voluntary sector organisations of whom a small part of their work is providing infrastructure services. Now, that clearly makes a big difference to the voluntary sector on the ground in these areas. Little things that councils for voluntary service used to do, like volunteer brokerage, often running payroll services for small voluntary organisations for whom doing so would be, you know, unfeasible. That infrastructure has in many places simply gone. And that has not been the case in the same way in other jurisdictions. There has been more continued support. Now, part of the reason why this is a bit of a curveball is because I really don't know what the situation is like outside of England. And that's part of, I guess, the challenge, but also the really exciting things about this project is that this is a superb case study in the actual difference that those different approaches has made. And in understanding that, we hope to be able to make recommendations as to the best way to support local, both kind of mutual aid, but also more traditional kind of philanthropic organisations to be best supported to deliver on local need, basically, and to be a kind of conduit in the way that kind of 19th century political theory would have it for people exercising their wants and needs to help others. Did I deal with that curveball all right?
What's really striking is how this is also affected by wider politics. So in Northern Ireland, obviously having disruptions with the overall government affected the way the voluntary and community sector could communicate or work with the government. On top of that, the changes that Eddie already described to local government and how local government could and wanted to react to changes, for example, in funding. So what I'm saying is this is a completely complex landscape that we observe even before the onset of COVID-19.
Devolution got more intense post 1999, but there was devolution before, but in different depths. So in Scotland, for example, there was deeper devolution than, for example, for Wales. But I think there's two key things that can talk about with devolution and the non-reserve policies for voluntary action. One, it's about partnership, and that's partnership between the sector and government. Jürgen's alluded to a partnership that was collaborative from 1997 to 2010. We entered the pandemic in England with a partnership that was more antagonistic between Westminster and the sector. I don't think we could ever describe the partnership between the voluntary sector and Scottish Government, Welsh Government, or the government in Northern Ireland as being antagonistic. There was a much more a partnership of collaboration and working together. And then the policies. So, for example, Big Society that David Cameron spoke about, that applied to England, not to the UK. So a lot of policies that we take for granted in England didn't cascade out to the four jurisdictions. The partnership in England has changed during the pandemic. Perhaps it's become a partnership of necessity now, as we have the growth in unmet need on a scale that would even surprise Beveridge than what he described in 1942.
I think that's really interesting, because I think that does speak to the wider issues within that this project raises, I suppose. So there is the voluntary sector response, but there is also the implications and the consequences for almost the state of the union, if you like, in terms of the implications of this change. And that, there was all the talk going around during the height of the initial lockdown that if you wanted to know what Westminster's policy was, just look at what Scotland were doing a week ago. And it was, you know, there was this very sort of antagonistic to and forth in terms of who was having the best public health response, who was having the best voluntary sector response, who was, you know. And I just think that is, if you'd said that this was going to be where we were in the terms of the geopolitics of the United Kingdom 12 months ago, you wouldn't have believed it. It's just incredible how much has changed in such a short time frame, you know. And I think this offers a really interesting case to try and capture some of that geopolitical change.
That's interesting. Do you think that's a permanent change? The fact that we see, you know, Nicola Sturgeon seems to have a much better, you know, from a non-expert viewpoint, she seems to have a much better handle on how to deal with issues around the pandemic. Do you think that has changed the relationship in a more permanent way? Or it's, you know, as soon as the pandemic is kept under control, it will revert to London and Westminster taking the lead on things. And things like, you know, whether it's more broadly or issues around volunteering and the response to a major calamity such as this and the way we deal with the volunteering element. Is it a long-term change or just an immediate one?
I mean, if we look at the Scottish numbers don't appear to be significantly better than the English numbers, but Nicola Sturgeon appears to be significantly better at talking to the media and you know, so I think that's interesting in itself.
Two observations. The question about how long, or, you know, how lasting is this? I think the one thing that we're seeing at the moment, the one thing that we can assess, is the level of disruption, both to our personal lives, but also to the relationships. And this is not just the relationships between the nations, but this is the relationships between the state and voluntary action, both the organized and less organized or self-organized. We can only assess the level of disruption at the moment. We don't know what that will lead to. But the important thing in that context is this is a health emergency. So how can we minimize the effects of the disruption in order to help with people's and the public health? That is what we're really talking about. And when we're looking at the potential recovery from the immediate health impacts, which may in fact be more long-lasting than we are currently anticipate, both physical but also mental health, then we will also have to turn our attention to the national recovery in terms of economy and other social institutions that have been severely shaken. Because my observation simply is that we need to assess the level of disruption and we need to see how we can minimize the negative effects of it.
We're not just looking at health, we're looking at social welfare. It's looking at unmet need, so it might be food poverty, it's mental health. So it's looking at a number of the giant evils to you if we're talking at Beveridge.
So how is it actually going to work in practice? How do you undertake research on lockdown?
you know, when you can't have more than six people meeting in a room, if that. Have you had to change your initial proposal based on the fact that we had the second lockdown and we're in three tiers?
So we always assumed that it would be very tricky to do anything face to face. And so in that respect, no, we haven't had to change. The reality of the world in April and May when we were writing this was we had no idea, really. We expected there to be, as Irene says, a kind of pathway towards recovery at this point. But at the same time, we were not expecting all of us to sit in a room at this point. That's partly pandemic related and partly due to the fact that there really are a lot of us from a lot of different places. And, you know, even without the pandemic, we'd have been putting a lot of money into Ryanair's budgets to try and all be in a room together at any point in time. So it was never really planned that way. And actually, it was quite that's worked quite well. In terms of the kind of broader question of how much more difficult is it to do a project when we're all remote and when the people we want to talk to are remote? Yes, I mean, we're lucky in that of the core team, we pretty much all have existing relationships with each other. And I think that would have been really hard to build virtually. But I think the fact that we know and trust each other is really, really important. In terms of the way in which we're speaking to voluntary organisations, to infrastructure bodies, I don't think we'd have done that particularly differently. I think to do something at pace and at scale would have necessitated doing it via online, you know, contact forms and things like that, rather than sort of going around and doing interviews or anything like that, which I think we wouldn't have been able to cover the amount of ground we proposed to. So actually, it fits quite nicely into the kind of COVID world we're in now, this bit of work, and we haven't particularly had to sort of bend around things.
But we're also learning. I think that's the other thing. Working in these changed circumstances, there are some elements that are becoming clearer are really quite difficult. So, for example, we're looking at consensus building. And consensus building in a Zoom meeting with 12, 18 people, that is a completely different scenario to if we had managed to at least once or twice get in a room together. You know, having that physical closeness so that you can observe people's body language, you see each other nodding to each other, not just to a screen. You see, you have the coffee break and have a chance to just clarify one particular thing. On one day, you could achieve in such a scenario a very different outcome compared to even several Zoom or online video conference meetings. We have applied different methodology to it. We're testing different methodology. We're looking at adapted Delphi exercises. We're looking at using theory of change models to assist with the building of shared understanding rather than just being an evaluation tool. Lots of different approaches from which we intend to learn. We will come out of this project hopefully with findings that are actually useful for people, but we will also come out of this project with some really in-depth learning about what it means to work across four nations with academic colleagues, with voluntary sector colleagues, with other stakeholders. We will be having a better understanding of how research in such circumstances can actually be undertaken.
This is the first ESRC project where I've had my research users as co-eyes. That is a fundamental change. And we've got four different policy contexts to produce research that's going to have meaning.
Just to get a sense of the historical context for where we are now, how does the UK in the 2020s compare either to the 1940s or late Victorians or other periods where volunteering has been a major part of the provision of services?
During the 1940s, the voluntary sector was very different to what it is today. But in the depths of the Second World War, the voluntary sector worked in partnership with the government, whether it was feeding displaced people, setting up the Older Persons Welfare Council, that is now Age UK. Unmet needs were identified. So there was a strong partnership between the Government of National Unity and the voluntary sector. There was a shared mission. But also during the Second World War, there was a recognition that not only had the war effort to be addressed, but an important element of the Government of National Unity in the war was to plan for the peace. There would always be a role for the voluntary sector, because the welfare state isn't as responsive as the voluntary sector. So there was a collaborative relationship. A number of key officials in government were sat on the boards of key voluntary organisations. So moving forward, 2010s, austerity, a very different relationship, more antagonistic, and also a questioning of the role of voluntary action. Should voluntary organisations ask uncomfortable questions? Should there be the campaigning? But that partnership has changed during the pandemic. There's a partnership of necessity that we've been writing about that's emerged. And it's interesting that the language that's been used during the pandemic, there's a lot of rhetoric about fighting battles, etc. So that a lot of people have been looking back to the 1940s to see if we can learn lessons.
I was going to say, it's really interesting what Irene says about this sort of antagonistic attitude, because I think that that is going to be something that we will be looking out for in terms of the relationships in the different jurisdictions, particularly about the way in which the government or the policymakers in those areas see the role of voluntary sector. But I cannot remember a government be so openly antagonistic towards particularly the campaigning aspects of voluntary organisations. And, you know, we have the chair of the Charity Commission last weekend writing a not in any way veiled criticism of the National Trust in the Sunday Telegraph. The idea that sort of charity should be doing anything other than, as Brooks Newmark said during his brief period as charities minister, sticking to their knitting, goes against what the government of England at least think. Now that has real implications for the role they see charities as having in, and volunteers as having in, the, as Irene says, in the kind of post-war or post-COVID settlement, because it will be as being uncritical service providers rather than all of the things that voluntary organisations have typically done around agitating for change on behalf of their constituencies. And I think that that's a really important moment to be looking at this as well. And it's why Irene's work comparing the 1940s to the present day is so important. And it's something we want to bring into this, is understanding how not just the kind of firm policy differences, but also the kind of softer rhetorical differences have a big impact on the way in which volunteering is seen as being part of this effort.
COVID-19 pandemic has in fact forced us to challenge what Rochester calls the dominant paradigm, which is the view that volunteering is all about service. Somebody tells you, please do this, you do it as a means of a gift, or you present, you know, you give your time, and that's it, that's done. And there's benefits associated with it for different people, including the volunteers, but that's the dominant paradigm about its service. And I'll give you the example, because this is about health and social care, as Irene absolutely rightly pointed out. The NHS already has about 3 million volunteers active within many of its different services or activities. And a few years ago, they decided that they wanted to double that number. At the very same time, they also have a drive, and that's a drive that's supported by government, which is about patient and public involvement, which is a democratization of the services and how the services are designed and to a degree as well monitored. And there is currently in the discourses of that very little connection. And we need to start to understand that, for example, during COVID-19, people just took matters into their own hands. They designed their own services. And it is those type of connections, first of all, the challenging of the dominant paradigm, but understanding what the volunteering or the voluntary action paradigm overall actually might be, that will help us, or that will maybe help us understand better what such a post-pandemic settlement might be like.
Do you see there being some kind of post-war settlement along the lines of the welfare state, where there's the government sees its role more as, you know, dealing with food banks or whatever? Do you see any appetite for there being a more constructive resolution of the current situation after this is resolved?
I think that's the sort of horns of the dilemma that we're in now. I think that there's a real tussle going on as to what the outcome of the response to the pandemic might be, and who is deemed to be needing to respond. I think, you know, that formulation of the response is something that we're right in the middle of at the minute, and I wouldn't know how to honestly answer that question. I think that we're going to find out, and I'm not sure, as Jürgen said earlier, maybe that we can do something that will help contribute to that. But I think there's a number of things at play here. There's I was at a book launch last week where a colleague was talking about a book they've just got out about mutual aid and the response to COVID, and taking the view that mutual aid as a concept is a fundamentally anarchist concept. And they'd done field work in London, and there was a schism within this mutual aid group in London between those people who wanted to politicise mutual aid and make it into a political act, and other people who were saying, well, keep the politics out of it. So, and that's kind of similar to what Eddie's talking about in terms of the approach within the charities commissioning these. So I think that we're really in the crux of that. You know, I think it's about how these things play out over the next 12 months that we'll really start to get an answer to that. But I don't think we're in a position to answer it at the minute. Sorry. Typical academic answer.
There's three points, I think, that I'd like to make for no other reason than I don't like my points in threes. The first one is, this is very much a collaborative project, and it is one of the few projects where substantial research resources are going directly to the collaborators within the field, those who will be using and working with the knowledge that we create. And also it enables us to combine knowledges, to use the historical background, the academic contexts and methodologies with the praxis of our colleagues in the various infrastructure organizations. So there's a real, I want to stress this, that this is a collaborative work, and that the methodologies are chosen to reflect that, and the resources are allocated to reflect this. The second one is my appreciation of the colleagues in the nations that endured for some time, and I'm speaking for myself there as well, my sort of ignorance of their situations. If nothing else that is coming out, that has come out of this project already from the development stage to now, is a genuine awareness that when we talk about voluntary action in the United Kingdom, we talk about voluntary action not just in England, and that we make that a conscious effort, and that we challenge politicians and others when they stand at the podium and declare a policy that is clearly just for England. They certainly don't clarify that it isn't for the entire UK. And then the last part is about managing expectations. This is an incredibly complex, this is one of the most complex projects that I've been involved in. It is also a very short period of time, and the land's shifting from underneath our feet while we are on it and trying to understand it. But we set out on this journey with a very clear mission. Irene described, and what Eddie described so well, it is about looking beyond the current disruption and seeing if there's something that we can find that will help our colleagues in the voluntary and community sector, and that will help individuals trying to gather what we've lost or trying to put together what was broken.
Thanks for that, Jürgen. I think that is a good place to end it, in just reiterating that point that it's not just the furthering of knowledge. It is looking beyond the current disruption and working on behalf of colleagues in the sector and across the sector. And I do wish you all good luck with what is going to be, as you say, one of the most complex projects that you've been involved in, and I'm sure colleagues as well have been involved in, the short time frame, the complexity of participants as investigators, as well as users and end users and stakeholders, and the shifting nature of the landscape, which is, as you say, shifting day by day. So thank you all for taking part in the podcast. It's been really interesting. Thank you, Irene Harder of Northumbria, Eddie Hogg of the University of Kent, Ewan Speed of the University of Essex, and Jürgen Grutz of the University of East Anglia. And I hope you can join me next time as we continue to explore the furthest reaches of Eastern Ireland.